Welcome to New World Notes, hosted by Kenneth Doust. This week, we pick up the second half of Adam Curtis's documentary, Love and Power. It's about computers, Wall Street, financial collapse, Monica Lewinsky, Alan Greenspan, and the torrid sex life of Ayn Rand. Well, worse things happen at sea, you know, so always look on the bright side of life, and please stay tuned. This week, we continue with the second half of Adam Curtis's interesting documentary from 2011, Love and Power. It's about three forces in America that their advocates claimed would empower the individual, expand democracy, and guarantee permanent prosperity and stability. These forces were heroic individualism, a la Ayn Rand, networked computers, and unrestricted financial markets. Back in the 1990s, the powerful Federal Reserve Board chairman, Alan Greenspan, strongly believed in all three. In fact, so strong and beneficent were these three forces that what governments should do is just get out of the way and let these forces work their magic. Or so powerful advocates argued. Except that it was all nonsense, and today the world is still suffering the evil consequences. Well, they seemed like good ideas at the time. And the worst of the three ideas, deregulated finance, is still official U.S. policy. Part 2 begins with the economic boom of the late 1990s, the Clinton-Greenspan years. Not all is rosy, though. The Clinton presidency is being incapacitated by the Monica Lewinsky scandal, and the financial giants are busily destroying the economies of South Korea, Thailand, and Indonesia. 10 years later, they will work the same magic here at home. Instead of expanding democracy, the computer revolution, too, seems to be concentrating still more power in the corporate elite. And Ayn Rand's illicit love affair ended even worse than Bill Clinton's. Well, it's a complicated story, and let's get back to it. Here is part two of Adam Curtis's Love and Power.
By 1997, the American boom was reshaping the whole world. Economists and bankers who saw the world as one giant economic system now dominated the American government. They believed that the way to achieve global economic stability was for nations to open themselves up to the free flow of capital. And the laboratory that they had created for this experiment was Southeast Asia. Under American pressure, countries like South Korea and Thailand had given up all restrictions, and Western capital flooded in. It helped fuel what was called the Asian miracle. But a group within the White House were worried that much of the Western money was going to fund a giant speculative bubble in property. And when the boom collapsed, the money would flee, leaving the countries like Thailand and South Korea decimated. The group were led by the economist Joseph Stiglitz.
The Council of Economic Advisers was very worried about these short-term speculative capital flows because while the countries benefit a little bit when the money comes in, when the money goes out, the countries are devastated. So it was not in the interest of Korea, and it was not in the interest of the United States. It was in interest of a very small group of people who make their money from these speculative, these short-term capital flows, bankers and hedge funds. It was a really very small group in whose interest it was.
The Council of Economic Advisers decided to warn the president. They wanted to persuade him to stop some of the more excessive short-term speculation in the Asian countries. But they came face to face with the Secretary of the Treasury, Robert Rubin. Rubin had previously run Goldman Sachs. And under his leadership, the bank had created many of the computer models that underpinned the boom. Rubin had a revolutionary vision of a world system completely open to the free flow of capital. Joseph Stiglitz, who headed the Council of Economic Advisers, was convinced that the Treasury was stopping the warnings reaching the President. He believed that Rubin and the Treasury had effectively become agents of the financial world, embedded in the heart of government.
Treasury had close connections with the financial markets. The Secretary of Treasury had come from the largest investment bank and went afterwards into the largest commercial bank. And these are the people with whom U.S. Treasury naturally interacts. And to Wall Street, we were threatening a bursting of the bubble. To Wall Street, we were threatening their profits. So the Treasury worked extremely hard to make sure the President never got to consider the issues, making sure that the perspectives of the Council of Economic Advisers,
which was you,
never reached the President.
So they kept your arguments from the President?
Effectively, yes.
What some people were beginning to see was that the computer networks and the global systems that they had created hadn't distributed power. They had just shifted it, and if anything, concentrated it in new forms. And some of the computer utopians from Silicon Valley were also beginning to realize that the World Wide Web was not a new kind of democracy, but something far more complicated, where power was exercised over the individual in new and surprising ways. Carmen Hermosillo had been one of the earliest believers in the new communities of cyberspace. Her online name was Humdog, and she lived on the West Coast. But then she lost faith, and she posted an attack which caused a sensation online. "It is fashionable to suggest," she wrote, "that cyberspace is some island of the blessed, where people are free to indulge and express their individuality. This is not true. I have seen many people spill out their emotions, their guts online. And I did so myself until I began to see that I had commodified myself. Commodification means that you turn something into a product which has a money value. In the 19th century, commodities were made in factories by workers who were mostly exploited. But I created my interior thoughts as commodities for the corporations that owned the board that I was posting to, like CompuServe or AOL. And that commodity was then sold on to other consumer entities as entertainment." "Cyberspace," she wrote, "is a black hole. It absorbs energy and personality and then represents it as an emotional spectacle. It is done by businesses that commodify human interaction and emotion. And we are getting lost in the spectacle."
She wore blue velvet. Bluer than velvet was the night.
In 1997, Bill Clinton made it clear to Monica Lewinsky that their love affair was over. Hurt and bewildered, Lewinsky poured out her feelings to her colleague Linda Tripp, who had become her friend. But in September of that year, Linda Tripp secretly began to record their phone conversations. At the very same time, on the other side of the world, the property bubble in Southeast Asia finally burst. Two enormous crises were about to engulf the world. One would strip the last remnants of power from Bill Clinton. The other would bring the global economic system to its knees. The dream of a stable world was about to be assaulted by the two uncontrollable forces of love and power. The Asian crisis began in Thailand. Hundreds of thousands of offices and apartments had been built, but no one wanted them. As the developers went bust and defaulted on their loans, Western investors panicked and rushed to take their money out of the country. The panic began to spread, first to South Korea. Housewives queued to give their spare dollars to the government to rescue the country. But it wasn't enough. Teams from the IMF flew in, and they offered billions of dollars in loans to stabilize the country's economies. But there was a price. The IMF said that the reason the crisis had happened was because the Asian economies weren't Western enough. In return for the loans, they would have to turn themselves into models of the free market. This meant cutting government spending and getting rid of corruption and nepotism in the ruling elites. Then the crisis got worse. It spread to Indonesia. Indonesia was ruled by President Suharto. He was an autocrat surrounded by a corrupt clique of advisers and family members. He refused to do what the IMF wanted. So the IMF turned to the US Secretary of the Treasury, Robert Rubin.
Well, our objective was not to reform the country for the sake of reform. Our problem, the problem that the international community faced, was that both the international markets and the domestic holders of capital were very quickly losing confidence in the Indonesian regime. And by that time, it was our view that if President Suharto was going to reestablish confidence, he had to deal seriously with corruption. And that was something that he simply was unwilling to do.
Robert Rubin and the U.S. Treasury were determined to force Suharto to their will. In an atmosphere of growing panic in Washington, Rubin's team began to argue that the overthrow of Suharto might be the only way to solve the crisis. President Clinton was now increasingly enmeshed in the crisis over Monica Lewinsky, and enormous political power was passing to Rubin and his Treasury team. They, and not the State Department, were now running America's foreign policy. And everything was judged by whether it was a threat to the global economic system.
There is no question that the Treasury Secretary, in this case me, got involved in sets of issues that went way beyond what Treasury Secretaries ordinarily got involved in. But the reason was that there was real risk that if Indonesia had chaos, political chaos I'm talking about, that could spread threatening in the interest of the global economy.
In January 1998, Suharto gave in and signed the IMF agreement, watched over by the head of the IMF, Michel Kamdasu. Indonesia received a massive loan to stabilize the economy. For a moment, it worked. But then, the strangest thing happened.
Indonesia's currency has collapsed, losing 80% of its value, and the economy is in ruins. With riots and looting breaking out across the country, there are fears that it's now on the brink of anarchy.
Indonesia's exchange rate crashed disastrously, and the economy went into freefall. But Indonesia was not alone. In every country that the IMF bailed out, like Thailand and South Korea, for a moment there was stability. And then the exchange rate collapsed. Rubin's critics in the White House began to argue that there was another agenda also at work in the bailouts. That part of their real function was to rescue the Western investors, not the countries. Billions of dollars were paid into the Asian banks by the IMF. But many of those same dollars were immediately used to pay off Western investors who wanted to get their money out of the country. And once that had happened, the economy crashed.
It was another illustration that the interest of the financial community dominated over other interests by providing mega-billion-dollar loans. The IMF was bailing out the Western investors and leaving the taxpayers in the countries further in debt because they had to repay the IMF.
The effect of the cuts was devastating throughout the region. In Indonesia, government subsidies were removed as instructed by the Western bankers. Prices soared, and within months, in a country of 200 million people, 15% of the male workforce lost their jobs. Economic output fell by 14%. As Robert Rubin had wanted, Suharto was forced from power, but at a very high price. The economy now lay in ruins, and ethnic and religious strife began. The same thing happened in Thailand and South Korea. Millions and millions of people fell back into the poverty that they thought they had escaped forever. By the middle of 1998, the Asian economies had collapsed. It was the most catastrophic economic disaster suffered by any countries since the Depression of the 1930s.
Many people cannot have the money, don't have the money. Many millions of people are unemployed. They don't have the job, they don't have the education. Education is expensive, hospital is expensive, everything is expensive for the common people.
Monica Lewinsky says that while you were in the Oval Office area, you touched her breast, would she be lying?
Bill Clinton had become president with the vision of using political power to transform America. But he had been persuaded to give away that power to the financial markets, with the promise that this time they would create a new kind of stability. A new kind of democracy, free of the corruption of elite politics. But it was now becoming clear that in reality, America's political power had just been transferred to another elite, the financiers and Wall Street. And when faced by a crisis, they had simply used that power to rescue themselves. In the process, far from creating stability, their actions were leading to a chaotic and far more unstable world. To the leaders of the Asian countries, this was just as much a corruption of power as anything their governments were guilty of.
Mahathir Mohamad, Prime Minister of Malaysia, 1981 to 2003.
Power corrupts, as much as government can become corrupt. When invested with absolute power, markets also can become corrupt when equally absolutely powerful. We are seeing the effect of that absolute power today, the impoverishment and misery of millions of people, and their eventual slavery.
What did you tell your cabinet, Mr. President?
Ask him.
Are you considering...
Do you think it went well?
Are you considering resignation, Mr. President?
Okay, I don't know if you saw that.
Right, Catherine, are you all set with the Northwest coming?
Did you see that look on his face? Great.
In the late 60s, early 70s, Ayn Rand had an affair with a married member of her inner circle, Nathaniel Brandon. Eventually, he broke it off, and Rand reacted with tremendous anger.
Ayn Rand's anger and despair destroyed the small, perfect world that she had built around her. The collective was torn apart by the revelation of her affair and by her violent reaction at her betrayal. And by the early 1970s, Ayn Rand was left almost alone. She still lived in her apartment by the Empire State Building, and she took up stamp collecting. One of the few people who remained loyal to her was Alan Greenspan, who worked in New York as an economic consultant to Wall Street.
It's feasible in a way in which it stays down and does not just merely drop and then bounce around and have within it, in a sense, an unstable future.
In 1974, President Ford made Greenspan the chairman of his Council of Economic Advisers in Washington. It was the beginning of Greenspan's rise to power. Rand was left alone in New York, but she wasn't lonely, she said. In her philosophy, all you needed was yourself, because you were the world.
What I've always thought was a sentence from some Greek philosopher, I don't unfortunately remember who it was, that I read at 16, and it's affected me all my life. I will not die, it's the world that will end. And that's absolutely true.
attack on the World Trade Center was an assault by political Islamism on American power, and on what the Islamists believe was the destructive force that drove that power, radical individualism. When the World Trade Center towers collapsed, everyone knew that everything had changed. But then it didn't. The system returned to normal. And the heroic individual who did this, and who bent history to his will, was Alan Greenspan. And he became the most powerful man in the world.
As we struggle to make sense of our profound loss and its immediate consequences for the economy, we must not lose sight of our longer-run prospects, which have not been significantly diminished by these terrible events.
But it started badly. A week after the attacks, the American markets opened again. Dealers waited to see what would happen.
Our heroes will now open the marketplace, the green button.
It was a disaster. Immediately, the market suffered the largest fall ever in its history. Two weeks later, the Enron scandal was revealed. And it quickly became clear that it was only one example of a vast corporate fraud. Since the early 90s, many major corporations had faked profits and hidden their debts, helped by some of the major accounting firms. It seemed as if the American economy might collapse. Greenspan took action. He dramatically cut interest rates again and again. His aim was simple: to encourage American consumers to borrow and spend. They and their desires were going to be the machine that stabilized the system.
For Hugh, today's rate cut is the culmination of an extraordinary few days for central banks. It's all part of a concerted global effort to bolster consumer confidence and make sure those consumers carry on spending money, because that is what's keeping economies afloat at the moment.
It was an enormous risk. By cutting the rates to almost zero, Greenspan was unleashing a flood of cheap money into the economy. And in the past, this had always led to inflation and dangerous instability. But this time, it didn't. A vast consumer boom began, bigger than anything ever before in history. But there was no inflation. Everything remained stable. It seemed that the system could manage itself without direct political control. But it was an illusion. The reason for the extraordinary boom was the very opposite. It happened because of a giant exercise of political power by an elite thousands of miles away on the other side of the world. The Asian countries, led by China, had decided that never again would they put themselves at the mercy of America and its financial elites, as had happened 2 years before. So the Chinese Politburo created a system to manage America. They deliberately held their currency's exchange rate at a low level. This meant that their exports were cheap, and Chinese goods flooded into America. And to pay for them, American dollars flooded into China. But instead of spending the money on their population, the Chinese leaders immediately lent the money back to America by buying government bonds. It was a perfect system of cheap goods and cheap money flowing into America, all controlled by the Chinese Politburo. And it was this that created the stability. From it came an orgy of lending by the banks to the poorest and least credit-worthy borrowers in the United States. It was a mirror image of what the West had done in East Asia in the 1990s. And just like then, out of it came a vast property bubble. It is as if over $1 trillion has been recycled, wrote one economist, to a third world developing economy that exists within America's own borders.
Thank you.
Chinese money had led America into a dream world. But the reason that so few bankers and politicians questioned it was because of their faith in computers. They were convinced that it was the computers that had brought the stability to the system. The machines created mathematical models that parceled out the loans and then hedged and balanced them so that there was no risk. But then, in 2008, that dream collapsed. Alan Greenspan's vision of a new planet and Gordon Brown's promise of no more boom and bust were revealed to be fantasies, built on a wave of financial speculation. That speculation had happened because those running the financial sectors, in America and Britain, had promised that they could create a new kind of market democracy that would be stable. But again and again, it had led to the opposite. Chaos and instability around the world. And now, finally, that had happened in the very heart of the West. But yet again, just as in Southeast Asia 10 years before, those running the financial sector now mobilize political power to rescue themselves and protect their supremacy. They asked the politicians to bail them out, and they agreed. And again, just as in Southeast Asia, the price is being paid by the ordinary people of the countries. And we are now living through a very strange moment. We know that the idea of market stability has failed, but we cannot imagine any alternative. The original promise of the Californian ideology was that the computers would liberate us from all the old forms of political control. And we would become Randian heroes in control of our own destiny. Instead, today, we feel the opposite. That we are helpless components in a global system. A system that is controlled by a rigid logic that we are powerless to challenge or to change.
And that was Adam Curtis's documentary, Love and Power, part one of his trilogy called All Watched Over by Machines of Loving Grace. It was adapted for radio and slightly condensed by me. This radio program is called New World Notes. I am the chief note taker, Kenneth Doust, and I thank you for listening. You'll find some more details of our program, pretty pictures, and an archive of our broadcasts online at newworldnotes.blogspot.com. We come to you from the spacious underground studios of WWUH-FM, a community service of that beacon of light in darkest Connecticut, the University of Hartford. Thank you for listening. Illegitimi non carborundum, and best wishes for the new year. Ciao.